thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 12 for the 10th of September, 2007. Productivity and Connectivity. I'm Dan Cohen. Welcome back once again to Digital Campus, our 12th episode of the podcast, and we're sitting around the virtual roundtable this week with much better Skype, thankfully, after last episode's debacle on Skype with all the problems that they had. But we're here with the regulars, Tom Scheinfeld of foundhistory.org. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
And Mills Kelly of edwired.org. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
And since I rarely mention my blog on the podcast, of course, I'm Dan Cohen, and I'm at the eponymous dancohen.org. Well, it is, our back-to-school edition. The three of us have begun the school year, and so we have lots to talk about, both in the news roundup, and then later on in the feature story, we're going to talk about one of the main things that we often encounter at the beginning of the semester, and actually at this point, with the way that the electronic world is going sort of all through the semester, and that is the issue of information overload and dealing with all the email we get from students, and if you're a student, all the email you get from professors, and also all the things we have to digest from libraries and online and news feeds and so forth. So we're going to look forward to that discussion coming up after the break. But first, we wanted to begin with the news roundup, as we do every week. And before we dig into the major news stories, I have to actually give some embarrassing news, actually, from the Dan Cohen household. I have to say, I haven't told the two of you guys, but I am now an iPhone owner.
You are.
Yes.
Did you pay 600 or 400?
No, 400. I got the late adopter discount from Steve Jobs there.
That was nice of him, really.
I have to say I buckled under from various pressures, but the main thing was just seeing one of our Zotero developers who has an iPhone that he has, how should we put this gracefully? He is extended through various unsanctioned means, and it really shows the power of the iPhone when you see these additional applications that you can put on there that are coming out. I mean, there's probably several dozen packages, and for instance, there's a really good book reader now for the iPhone. Again, this is sort of unofficial gray market area, but the book reader is just astonishing. I mean, the quality of the text on the iPhone is really great, and I could really see some good applications. There's all kinds of amazing stuff that's coming out, and I just wonder, with all this development going on by third parties, whether this will sort of push Apple to come out with their own solution. But anyway, since we've been talking about the iPhone, I suppose I had to embarrassingly admit it after saying, I believe on episode number 10 or 9, that I was going to wait at least a year, so here I am.
So, Tom, who won the off-school on when he was actually going to buckle under? We'll have to check and see.
All right, who do I owe dinner to? Probably several people.
Yeah, probably your wife.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, okay, in actual news, you know, it is back-to-school season, and a couple of stories caught our eye here at Digital Campus for players outside of the academy getting into the online learning business. Two major players, actually, Yahoo and the New York Times. Maybe we'll start with the New York Times. So, Tom, do you have a good sense of what the New York Times is trying to do with this online endeavor that they just launched?
Well, I don't think anybody really has maybe a good sense, except maybe the players involved. And I think the New York Times has partnered with Mount Holyoke College, Stanford University, NYU, a few other universities to essentially provide online courses, non-credit courses, but paid courses in various subjects taught by faculty members at those institutions. And I guess what they're going to do is they're going to use some of the New York Times technologies, some of the technologies that they've developed for publishing, sharing, exchanging information, along with some New York Times content as well, I guess, maybe course packs with New York Times, bundled New York Times articles, or maybe with I don't know if this is the case. I haven't seen anything about this, but possibly specially produced content by New York Times correspondents to create these online courses. It's hard to say, I think, where it's going to go. Part of me thinks it's just kind of a marketing partnership where these institutions are using kind of the marketing reach and power of a brand like the New York Times to bring some money in these non-credit courses. But who knows? Maybe it will actually be a more substantive partnership than that.
And, I mean, isn't this something that's been done before? You know, I think inside the article on Inside Higher Ed mentioned Fathom, the initiative company actually set up by Columbia University, I believe, and several other partners that tried to do this in the early part of the decade. I suppose that things have changed online. That article pointed out, I think they spoke with the former CEO of Fathom, and she had mentioned that, with podcasts sort of coming online and widespread availability of blogs and high readership of blogs, that people are now used to sort of going online to learn. But I still wonder about some of the environment for, you know, paid online learning, a kind of non-credit online learning, versus... you know, what's already out there on the web. There's a lot of good podcasts. I hope one of ours, sometimes we put out decent free educational content on this podcast. Why would someone pay for a non-credit course? Maybe I guess we'll have to look at how it's exactly put together. Maybe it works for certain topics and not, let's say, history.
Yeah, my take on it is that colleges and universities have been offering non-credit educational experiences to their alumni for years as a way of bonding those alumni to the institution. You can take summer courses, you can do study tours, sort of academic tourism. They have all sorts of different things for their alumni. And so I think the interest for the institutions is to kind of continue that process but have somebody else produce the media part of it for them, because they don't have the capacity to produce multimedia extended learning opportunities like this. Instead, they always invite you to campus, or they send one of their professors to a place where there are big clusters of alumni. So for them, I think the advantage is really going to be to extend that process that they've been engaged in for a while into the online environment, and to get the New York Times as a media company both to help with the branding of it and also to pay really for a lot of the production expense. For the Times, it seems to me that the real advantage is that this is just another part of their transformation into a media company instead of just a newspaper company. And so they get the kind of reverse advantage of the brands of the educational institutions to lend some credence to the endeavor that they're engaged in, that they're not just repackaging educational content out of their own experiences, but they're really providing you access to well-known and excellent teaching professors. So I think it's kind of a mutual advantage in that sense, right. But I think it's really all about the media capacity of the Times and the brands.
Yeah, I mean, they've got really all their stuff online now, and they're clearly poking out in a bunch of different directions with trying to find subscription-based, they tried this... The Times Plus, or what did they call it for a while, where they had
Select, right?
Of course, right? Where they tried to have some subscriptions for a while, and they're sitting on giant servers full of really high quality content. I guess it makes sense for them to do this. I'm still a little unclear about the market, but I guess we will see if 2007 is a better year for it than at the height of the .com boom with Fathom.com. Yahoo at the same time seems to have taken a different approach with Yahoo Teachers, and I thought this was pretty interesting. I mean, it looks more like a peer-to-peer network. Am I right about that? Some way for students or for teachers to sort of share, let's say, lesson plans or curricula. It's a little unclear, but it's at teachers.yahoo.com. Has anyone taken a look at this?
Yeah, I looked at this because as soon as I heard about it, because this is actually an idea that I had a couple of years ago.
And, I know, Mills. I felt so bad for you when
I
saw it.
And I thought, oh, God, they finally, you know, somebody beat me to it, and with somebody with money beat me to it. I mean, Tom and I had, I guess, the first conversations about this probably close to 3 years ago now.
Yeah.
And we talked to a variety of vendors who might provide the platform for it, and basically we just couldn't find a way of financing it. But I think this has legs. I think this is a project that really is going to go somewhere because there's such a tremendous need for teachers, especially young teachers, to be able to network with each other and share lesson plans and share PowerPoint presentations and all those kinds of things that they use every day because there's such a generational transition going on in K-12 education right now. And all these young teachers who end up in communities where they don't know anybody, they're all wired together through Facebook and whatever. And so to have something like this is going to be a natural for them. And I expect that this is going to be a real winner.
Yeah, you know, looking at it, it seems to me that the key here, again, thinking about what has changed in the last 5 years, I think it is No Child Left Behind. You know, one of the things they mention on their homepage is to share standards-based curriculum.
Yeah,
And so you could see, you know, the high-tension act, that high-tension wire act that is, you know, being a third-grade teacher, having to prepare your students for the exam. And suddenly you can go online, get, you know, good lesson plans for a particular, you know, aspect of mathematics or vocabulary or something like that, rather than coming up with it yourself. I mean, what all these teachers are complaining in elementary school is about the preparation time and the amount of time it takes to you know, come up with good lesson plans that will help students learn to ace the test. And I think this is probably coming at just the right time. Although, Mills, I think you should reserve the right to sue, like several other Harvard former undergrads are thinking or are suing Facebook for the idea. Well, no, I was there. I remember you guys having this conversation. Yeah. So,
were you bunking by any chance with anyone at Yahoo when you came up with this idea?
I'm gonna have to go back through all my notes and see who was in the meetings where I talked about this, and do any of them now work for the Yahoo Teachers project?
Yeah,
could be my meal ticket for the next few years.
Absolutely, remember us when you're big, Mills. Well, in another area that we've talked more about is Google Books, which seems to have had a very busy summer actually, and there were a bunch of stories that came out over the last week of things that they've added to Google Books. By the way, I don't know if the two of you have seen Rob Townsend's very good article in the American Historical Association's perspectives for the month of September. It's not online yet, but I'll link to it from my blog and from the Digital Campus blog when it comes online. But you know, he put together a sort of critique of Google Books in the spring, and he expanded that out based on some critiques that people made of it. And I think it's, as it stands right now, it's probably the best critique of Google Books in terms of, you know, problems with quality, problems with sharing, and those sorts of things. What's interesting is that what came out in the last week, I think, begins to address some of the criticisms against Google Books in terms of it being more closed than we'd like. And I've been one of the critics about this, and have blogged most recently about them needing to open up better with an API. But you know, now, just to go through the list here, I mean, the things that you can do with Google Books, it really is not available anywhere else. First of all, the clipping story. I mean, this is something very simple, but I think will really extend the reach of Google Books and make it much more usable. You can now go into Google Books and drag your mouse over a certain section of text, as long as it's in the public domain, so a full text. Remember that most books after 1923 will not be available in this fashion, although there are many books that evidently authors and publishers have allowed Google to add this feature to. But as long as it's available for full view, that is, you can see every page of the book rather than getting those little text snippets when you do a search, you just drag your cursor over a section and a little sort of clipping icon appears, and you can clip that and then take that section and embed it in your blog, embed it in a paper with a link to that section in the book. You really begin to get that feel for the way in which they really could connect up this giant database of text with other other texts, other writing, secondary sources, etc. Have either of you tried this out? It doesn't work every time, but it is really pretty astonishing when it does work right. And what you get, it looks like a sort of teared piece of the book.
What I find really interesting about this is kind of the way that the Google parent company has taken a lesson sort of from their relatively recent acquisition, YouTube, and in that it's not just providing the access to the books that's interesting about Google Books and having this vast database of scanned books. It's providing the ability to share that. Like, what makes YouTube interesting is not so much that they've got lots of movies online. It's that you can take those movies and share them very easily on your own blog, on your Facebook page, wherever you want to, like, kind of add that little embed text. You can add a movie. They're doing really pretty much the same thing now with their book text, and I think that's
their maps. Recently, a couple of weeks ago, they added the ability to embed a map as well. So right. You can really begin to think about, for let's say student assignments, where students would do a paper online, embed a map, and you can embed a map with items embedded in that, like little flags that say, here's what happened in my history at these locations. You can footnote it. You could point back to the book that you got a footnote from. I think you're right. That's a really interesting point, Tom, about, learning from YouTube, which really pioneered that. And I think that's what really made YouTube take off, is the ability to sort of cut and paste this stuff into different web environments. They also added a feature to save books into what they call My Library. So it's you can set up a sort of personal library of Google Books. And this can include both full text, in other words, public domain and full text available books, as well as books that are not full text. And so this competes directly with services like probably most prominently Library Thing, and which is really a kind of small independent a small operation run by Tim Spaulding and a few others that has allowed people to sort of create virtual bookshelves and then to share those bookshelves with other people and to see, sort of expose your library to the world. Well, now you can go into Google Books, and if you see something you like, you can save it into your library. You can categorize it, essentially giving it tags. And then I think, most interestingly, since there are other services like this, not only Library Thing, but also Shelfari, which is an Amazon.com company. But really, the amazing feature of this is you can put together a bunch of books in your library and then do full text searches of those books. And that, I think, is really interesting. I mean, there you can see a lot of great applications, both for the classroom, but then I'm also thinking for scholarship. I mean, you could put together a set of, let's say, Victorian novels, let's say 1,000 Victorian novels, and then search through all those novels at one time. That is something we couldn't do before last week. So I think that this is a really interesting development over at Google Books.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that we're going to have to figure out in the next, in the next year or so, how we're going to incorporate this into things like historical methods courses, and how are we going to teach our students how to use this kind of thing effectively. I think that's going to be a real challenge.
Oh, it's going to be a tremendous challenge. It speaks to the issue we're about to discuss after the break of information overload. I mean, just the example I gave, what do you do to a student, or what do you tell a student that's, looking at 1,000 Victorian novels, whereas they might have just looked at 10, let's say, for a literature class or a history class. It really gets into all kinds of questions about what scholarship and learning should look like. Another small feature that they added that was sort of related to this, they're clearly doing their own pre-processing of the text, and particularly finding passages that are what they call popular. So they have this new feature. If you go and look at the about page for a book in Google Books, it will tell you the 10 passages from the book that are most quoted in other books. This is just a really interesting application of the database. It's imperfect now. If you try it out, it will get things wrong. For instance, if a book it talks about Shakespeare a lot and quotes Shakespeare a lot, then it will say that the most popular passages in those books are actually ones that come from Shakespeare and not the author. In other words, they come from the primary text. So they obviously haven't figured out a way to disambiguate the primary and the secondary text. But still, I think, you know, it opens up some really interesting applications for, again, for scholars and students. One final aspect of Google Books is they're really starting to work more on combining it with their mapping system. And there was a great post on Inside Google Book Search. It's a blog that you can subscribe to from the Google Book Search team about integration with Google Earth, where they're now able to extract all the locations in a book, the text of a book, and put it right on to Google Earth. And so you open up that file into Google Earth. Your mind starts spinning, thinking of ways to use this, although maybe it's a distraction. I guess that remains to be seen. Okay, well, lots of things to discuss on this very topic of, you know, what do you do with everything that you can now extract from Google Books, as well as many other things, as we'll discuss in a few minutes. Well, as we just discussed, with Google Books, you're now getting millions of books, and you can now search through the giant amounts of text. And if that's not enough, we're already overwhelmed by email and by some of us, by our RSS news readers. And Mills, I've heard that this semester you have 100 students who are blogging, and so you have to read all their blogs. And,
that is correct.
Oh, goodness. I only have 20 blogs to read this semester, but I'm going to do the same thing next semester. So, you know, I think we're all dealing with this. And, you know, whether you're a student or teacher or scholar, researcher, we really are dealing with an age where we're just swamped by information. And I think that, you know, there's a couple of things that we wanted to discuss on the podcast. We wanted to sort of go over, you know, how the three of us handle it. And I don't think we're perfect by any stretch of the imagination. Tom and Mills, I think you'd probably agree with me there. We're often overwhelmed. And but, you know, we try to do our best, and maybe we have some pointers that will be helpful for the audience. And then to sort of think through, you know, well, does this information overload, hurt other aspects of our lives? And, you know, thinking about, you know, how do you start a major project like a book, let's say, or an exhibit at a museum, or to conceptualize a new project at work, or start a research paper as a student, when, you know, you're dealing with an information stream that is filled with hundreds of little interruptions every day. I think these are really big questions. But let's start really with these first questions of just, you know, how do you actually handle the information flow? Mills, what do you do? What are your tricks? What secrets do you have for us and the audience?
I never communicate with students.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
You hold yourself up.
Yes. That's right. I never respond to email. I never answer phone messages. It works really well.
That does work very well. Yes, off the grid. Okay, that's probably
the first
point.
After about 3 weeks, they just give up. No, right. When I switched from other forms of communication with students to blogs, my life got so much easier because what I did then was, instead of them emailing me constantly with questions, they blogged about their questions. Other students in the class answered their questions for them, so that cut way down on the amount of email that I was getting. But the other thing I do is I tell them, as you mentioned at the outset there, I have 102 students at last count this semester, each of whom is writing something every week in one of the class blogs, and that's just way too much content for me to manage. I mean, I use, you know, the Google Reader to manage the RSS feeds, and that kind of helps organize it on my screen, but it's still way too much content. I just don't have that much time. So what I do is I tell my students that I will be reading what they wrote during the semester, but that I'm not going to be reading everything that they write. And I have a cheat sheet. And in the first half of the semester, I make sure that I comment on everybody once. And in the second half of the semester, I make sure that I comment on everybody once. Sometimes I get involved in a conversation on the blog with a group of students who are interested in a particular topic, but I make sure that everybody has at least one comment from me, which gives them the sense that I'm reading more than I probably actually am. But I really depend on the other students in the class to carry on some of that for me, because they have to comment on each other's postings and that sort of thing. So, and they certainly alert me if there's ever anything untoward or unpleasant going on in the blog. But then at the end of the semester, the blog management, blog interface really makes it easy to manage going back through the students' writing. And so as I'm trying to figure out a grade for their blog during the semester, I tell them that they have to tell me what they think their best blog posting in the semester is, and then I'm going to pick one or two more at random beyond that, and I'll probably base their grade on those rather than the entire corpus of what they wrote. Because they might write something about some article they saw in the Washington Post about Wikipedia, or they might post something about a student organization project that they want to alert everybody in the class to. So, you know, that's noise. I'm not going to read that kind of thing. So this system works pretty well for me. It's still hard with 102 students, but it does work a lot better.
That seems like great advice, and something that I'll have to think about just reading the 20 blocks in preparation for next semester. Tom, how do you handle all of your email and reading that you do online?
Yeah, I have a slightly different problem, because most of what I do is manage, you know, a set of some large, some small digital history, public history projects. And I have just a huge load of email that I have to manage. And you know, sometimes I do that more effectively, sometimes I do it less effectively. I tend to switch technologies a lot, which probably wastes a lot of time. But what I'm doing right now, actually, I'm pretty much using Google's suite of productivity tools almost exclusively.
Which ones do you use in particular?
Gmail, Google Calendar, Google Reader, Google Docs, and actually Google Notebook. So I'm using those pretty heavily to manage email, RSS feeds, calendar, and to take notes. And I find especially Gmail to be very good. I know this is something a lot of people use, but I've actually moved all my old email into Gmail, which took me forever, but has been really worth it, because I've almost entirely eliminated any folders or tags for my email, because the search for Gmail, and I've got 50,000 email messages dating back to the late 90s, and the search is so good that that I really don't need to spend a lot of time now filing and sorting email. So that's been one thing that's been really good. At the same time, I think one of the problems we all have now is kind of the tyranny of email. And I think we tend to get really stuck in our email and stuck in our inboxes, to the point where we really don't do anything else but email. And our jobs are not to be email correspondents. Our jobs are to do whatever it is we're doing, teaching,
right,
or researching or writing or managing humanities projects. And so I do find it really useful. I've developed some tricks to kind of stay away from my email at times. I mean, one of the good things is to just like say to yourself when you wake up in the morning, I'm not going to open my browser till noon. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to open my email client until noon, because it allows you to do those other things that are off email. Because I think as soon as you dive into your email box, it's sometimes really hard to extricate yourself. So that's one thing I have. Another thing that I've done actually is to set up another profile on my computer. So there's, you know, my main profile with all my documents and all my you know, email and all my bookmarks and everything. But I've got another one, another login that I can log into, which is kind of just a clean and empty user account on my personal machine that doesn't have all those distractions of, you know, all my RSS reader and my email client, where I can just do some writing, or I can just do some planning.
That's great.
And then there's a few little other things that I've come across that kind of do the same thing. And this is maybe the best thing I have to offer for people who are trying to get some writing done. There's a little program, and it's free. It's called Write Room, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes. And what it does is it essentially just kind of, you launch it, it takes over your computer, not in a bad way though, and it just creates a black screen with a blinking green cursor. And it's just a hugely simple word processor with just green text on black screen. With it hides your toolbar, it hides your start menu and all of that. It's just like a blank canvas and just hides all those distractions and really can help you write. So those are just kind of the things that I do to try to keep me focused and keep even if there is this information overload, to keep it from drowning me.
Yeah. Wow, this is a bunch of great tips from both of you. You know, that Write Room, I tried that for a while, and there was actually another program that would just white out or black out all the other windows on your Mac, other than the one you're looking at. And the problem that I found is that I think a lot of the writing that I do, I need stuff from somewhere else, you know, from the web or from an email. And so I found I had to keep leaving the program to do that. It's one of the reasons I'm really looking forward to. There's a new feature in Leopard, which is the upcoming version of the Mac operating system, that will actually darken the other windows. Sort of, it almost looks like night, but you can still see them vaguely. So they kind of de-emphasize the other windows, because most computer environments, everything is this bright white behind the window you're looking at, and so you're seeing other stuff, and it's really foreground. Everything's in the foreground for you. So I think that kind of a feature is really something that people look forward to. You know, from what I've read, that, you know, the key is, you know, everybody has their own system, but I think the people who are successful, as both of you clearly are better than I am, is that they limit they sort of funnel everything into a specific environment. You know, and so for some people that's, you know, that's just a specific program. You know, some people have amazing to-do lists and everything goes into the to-do list that they have to do. It sounds like, you know, Mills, for instance, you're bringing everything into WordPress and having everything there. You just go to your dashboard and you can see sort of panoramically your entire class, and you can sort of from that one point, you're at the mountaintop, and you can kind of look down and look at a specific student or look at what's going on in the class in general. That's, you know, again, that sort of single point. You know, Tom, it seems like for you, the Google Apps have been really a consolidated environment where you can get a lot done. And particularly, it sounds like Gmail is something for you. You know, I'm still operating in several different environments. I use, and I've been using it since it launched. I think it's a great web application called Backpack. And I think, Tom, you use that as well sometimes.
Yeah, I have had a kind of love-hate relationship with Backpack, and I've gone to it and gone away from it. You know, we've had a kind of rocky love affair, Backpack and I. But yeah, it is a great thing.
It's sort of like a personal wiki or a place that you can really quickly set up lists for different projects, and it's sort of like, you know, maybe a single user project management for your life. But I could see how it, you know, I've also kind of gone in and out of using it well. But that is where I keep my to-do lists, and I actually have a bunch of different lists, and I try to keep all my work stuff separate from my, you know, home stuff, separate from, you know, class to-dos and things like that, so I can try to knock them out.
There are some pretty good online kind of personal project management, personal task management
packages out there. The backpack is definitely one. The same company that builds at 37 Signals has a kind of a more enterprise or professional version or similar software called Basecamp for real kind of web project management.
Right. And we should mention that that's what we use at the Center for History and New Media now for all of our project management.
Yeah, and it really is a nice system. There's another thing that's fairly similar to Backpack, but I think it has a little bit more functionality, although the trade-off is that the interface isn't quite as clean and svelte, is something called Remember the Milk, which is kind of a stupid name, but it's a good product. And there are others out there that can help with. I think you're absolutely right, Dan. This consolidating function is very important, I think, if you're going to manage so that you have a kind of a single intake point for all of your information where you can, separate the wheat from the chaff and then focus entirely on what's important.
Yeah, I've tried, I think now finally with some success on email prioritization too, because I get just a ton of email from a number of different angles, and you know, projects at the Center for History and New Media, things from students, things from friends and family, things from colleagues, you know, just all kinds of different areas. And you know, I think I've now come in, you know, into a system of, you know, most email programs will allow you to, for instance, flag an email as being important or that you can rank it. And I would, you know, encourage our audience to check out the various ways of sort of ranking your email. And then you can sort of quickly switch views and see, okay, which ones do I really need to respond to today and which ones can wait a week or a month. Actually, Tom, I took your advice and looked into a little bit on the getting things done system, and I'm not good about systems, as you've probably already figured out. But one aspect of that really helped me, which is to you know, I just have three folders now. In I use the Mac Mail program, not Gmail, you know, one folder of just you know, an action folder of things that I really need to respond to, one which is sort of for reference. So you know, for instance, in preparation for this week's podcast, I could store some email in that folder that I knew I'd have to look back on, but that shouldn't be in some kind of folder that's really about replying to the email. And then another folder that I call waiting, which is just, you know, email that I am going to have to respond to, but it has to wait for some other thing to happen. And I think just with those three, I finally managed to get some system. But, you know, before that, I had a kind of 1-2-3 prioritization ranking scheme, but you know, it's hard. Even with these systems, inevitably, you know, we get caught behind. And you know, is that maybe the issue here? Is that it's one of expectations, Mills? I mean, I kind of felt like that's something that you were trying to get across. Is that, you know, part of what we have to do is sort of manage expectations. And I know you were sort of kidding about the email, but you know, is it time where, you know, everyone realizes, wow, everyone's swamped by a lot of email, and it's okay if you don't get back to someone for a long time? Or is this something we have to broadcast that, hey, look, I've got too much to do and I might not ever get back to you?
I'm not ready to declare email bankruptcy yet, but and I think I've kind of gotten it under control, because one of the things I've done is just every email that I read now, I ask myself, do I really have to respond to this? I mean, are they really looking for a response? And I never send the email anymore that says thanks for the something that somebody else sent me, because when you aggregate all those thanks emails over the course of a year, it probably takes 2 days worth of time that you could better use somewhere else. The other thing is, I don't respond to work emails on the weekend. I will occasionally respond to friends and family over the weekend, but I do not respond to people from work. I don't respond to my students. And this is just kind of behavior modification for everybody who's in my email circle, is that when I'm at home on the weekend, I'm either working on stuff that I really need to get done for work, and so therefore I'm not going to respond to emails, or I'm with my family. And so, you know, I work very hard Monday through Friday, and sometimes I work on Saturdays, but on Saturdays I don't respond to work emails, and that really helps a lot too.
Well, what about that, Mills? I mean, that does raise the sort of final question that we wanted to cover about, you know, how do you do something big? I mean, in this age of lots of little annoyances like millions of blog posts and emails. How do you start a big project? How did you you've started to work on a new book project? How do you carve out the time for that? And I mean, Tom, I think you had the good advice of just not opening your browser and not opening your email, let's say, until noon. What other techniques can we do to do something that really requires a concerted effort and, you know, new kinds of thinking rather than little email responses or blog posts?
I just started a new project, and the only way I'm getting anything done on it is that I get up an hour earlier in the morning now and before anybody else in my house gets up. And so I'm up very early in the morning, and I sit down at the computer, and I work for an hour and a half or so, maybe 2 hours, depending on when everybody else gets up. And so I get work done then, and that's just really the only time of the day when I can carve that out. Because by the end, if I tried to add an hour or two at the end of the day, I wouldn't be able to think straight. So that's really the only way I can do it. And when I'm at my desk at home doing that, I do not connect to the internet.
So it seems like we've come full circle. Going off grid does seem to be actually a viable strategy, I suppose, right? It's just unplug, off the Wi-Fi.
I think so. I mean, I think one of the things a lot of us have forgotten too is the telephone. I think, you know, we send emails, like Mills said, for all these little thank yous, and we send, you know, we take, you know, 20 minutes to craft an email that would take 30 seconds to take care of over the phone. So I think some of the solution is to disconnect.
Right, right. And to use phones, which is precisely the reason that I bought the iPhone this week. As we do every week, we like to end the show with going around the horn and throwing out some links or resources or tools that we found over the past couple of weeks. And maybe we'll start with you this week, Tom.
Yeah, I've got a tool. I was talking about Gmail and the Google Apps suite that I've been using so much in the last segment. One of the things that makes it actually usable for me is this little Firefox add-on called Customize Google that I use. Basically, what it does is it allows you to make some minor tweaks to the Google Apps and actually the Google web search interfaces, so that, for instance, you can get rid of all the ads so that your Gmail doesn't have ads. Because I think one of the things that really annoys people about using webmail clients are the contextual ads that the program puts into all your emails. This can get rid of those. It allows you to hide certain of the menu items if they're not things that you use. And it allows you to set security settings differently than the default settings that Google provides. So it does a lot of little tweaks to the user experience of the Google apps that just makes it a little more usable for kind of everyday and power users. So it's Customized Google.
Great. Mills, what do you have for this week?
My site this week is actually a very useful teaching site for people teaching history and sociology or administration of justice, anything like that. It's The Famous Trials by Douglas O. Linder from University of Missouri Kansas City Law School. And he's collected, I don't know, looks like about 35 famous trials, mostly from American history, but not entirely. There's for instance, the Dingo trial from Australia in 1982 and the trial of Socrates, but mostly it's American history, the Amistad trial, the O.K. Corral trial of the Earp brothers, the Mississippi burning trial, the Oklahoma City bombing or O.J. Simpson. And it's a really, really nice teaching resource because he's combined kind of the crucial documents. So, for instance, in the Clinton impeachment trial, there's the Starr report and Clinton Senate testimony and a deposition from Monica Lewinsky. And all of those kind of crucial documents are there, but it's not information overload. It's not the full record of any of these trials. It's just enough to teach them. And so it makes a really nice teaching resource. So I use it a lot. I like the site.
Yeah, it's a great
very,
site.
Very, very appreciative of Linder for putting it up.
Yep. It doesn't have the world's best web design, but it's got fantastic content. And it's one of the sites that Roy and I highlighted in Digital History. For this week, I wanted to point to one to-do list, if you're shopping around for a to-do list. And it is from the folks at 37 Signals, which produces Backpack and Basecamp and all these other tools we use. But this is just their stripped-down to-do list, and it's just called Tada List, TADAList.com. And it's just the simplest way to really get a to-do list on the web. And, one advantage of it being on the web is it's really great for multiple users. So if you have to coordinate something with your partner, you can go ahead and or a group, you can put it up on the web, check things off. It's got all the real usability and beautiful design that all the products from 37 Signals has. And what's really nice is you can also subscribe to the to-do list via RSS. So again, thinking of our theme of trying to aggregate all of your stuff that you're doing in one place, I really use Google Reader very aggressively for a lot of different reasons. I subscribe not only to blogs, but a lot of different kinds of feeds. And so you can actually subscribe to a to-do list right in your reader. And so see as things get checked off right in your reader, which is a really nice way of again, sort of just getting one web page that gives you an overview of your world. Well, one final site that the three of us actually wanted to highlight, since this podcast will be coming out on September 10th, is that September 11th will, of course, be the 6th anniversary of the terror attacks of 9/11/2001. And, of course, the Center for History and New Media, along with the American Social History Project, has put together a site called the September 11th Digital Archive at 911digitalarchive.org. It's one of the best known sites for remembering 9/11 and contains over 150,000 digital objects contributed by tens of thousands of people from around the world, email and artwork and photographs and stories, video, audio, BlackBerry communications, PDFs, all kinds of things from that day. It's a really comprehensive archive that was put together not only by us, but also by all of the many contributors. And it's a great way to sort of, if you want to, wake up on 9/11 and just browse the collection a little bit, get a sense of what other people were doing that day and what they thought about that day. And I think it's a good way to remember the day. Again, the September 11th Digital Archive at 911digitalarchive.org. Well, we'll be back again in 2 weeks for another episode of Digital Campus. Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country